Welcome to the Big Fat Farm Show on KSJD, where we talk about anything farm, fresh, and food related. My name is Sarah Severson. I know you guys know we're doing a pledge drive today. You can feel free to call in your pledges at 970-564-0808 or pledge securely at ksjd.org. Today we have in the studio with us Travis Custer of San Juan Mycology. Welcome to the show, Travis.
Thanks for having me, Sarah.
Yeah. So let's start out. What is mycology?
Yeah, sure. Mycology is the study of fungi. And particularly our company cultivates gourmet mushrooms for local farmers market and wholesale. We're also looking into doing what's called mycoremediation, which is the study of fungi and how they can interact with cleaning environmental pollutants.
Wow, so fascinating. Two ends of the spectrum in terms of eating and some remediation.
Yeah, exactly.
For soil. So tell me, how does it actually work in terms of growing a mushroom in a domesticated setting? I've seen them in the wild, but what happens in a domesticated setting?
Yeah, so a lot of people, you know, it's kind of a mystical part of nature. We work with a group of fungi called saprophytic mushrooms. So these are fungi who are nature's decomposers. They degrade lignin and dead wood.
What's lignin?
Lignin is a structural component of woody plants.
Okay.
So those are the easiest relationships to recreate in an agricultural setting. Essentially, at our cultivation, the process starts in a lab setting where we get a mushroom culture from a particular species that we're interested in. We expand that culture onto petri dishes and then eventually onto sterilized wheat. And this allows us to create what's called spawn. Spawn is then further expanded to bags of sawdust, and that's what the fruit body of the actual mushroom comes off of. And that whole process takes anywhere from 2 to 4 months, depending on the species.
And you said you work with saprophytic fungi.
Saprophytic, yeah.
Saprophytic, thank you. Are there a large number of fungi species, or I don't...
There's an estimated 1.5 million species of fungi on this planet.
Wow. There's
basically three main groups, saprophytic being the decomposers. There's also fungi known as mycorrhizal fungi. These are fungi that share symbiotic relationships with plant roots. And then there's also parasitic fungi, kind of a smaller group, but they have a parasitic relationship either on other fungi or plants. And so, again, really the relationship that's most easily recreated in an agricultural setting is the saprophytic, because all we need for that is carbon-based dead material.
Boy, and that sounds like a very unique part of agriculture. I don't know, actually, anyone besides yourself and your partner, Gabe, that are doing mycology as an agricultural practice. Are there very many mycologists around the country that are doing it agriculturally?
It's definitely pretty small. I mean, if you're comparing it to, say, vegetable production, it's a really small community of people. But its importance in agriculture is paramount. I mean, we have to remember that fungi, particularly the saprophytic fungi, but also mycorrhizal fungi, are the cornerstones of soil and soil health. We wouldn't really have soil on this planet without fungi. Because they take dead material and they basically are nature's way of composting in conjunction with environmental conditions and bacteria. But also, you know, fungi play a major role in taking carbon-based material and turning it into humus, which allows plants to grow in the first place. And then mycorrhizal fungi play in that they specifically allow plants to interact with their environment and uptake nutrients. Somewhere around 90% of all plants share relationships with mycorrhizal fungi, and that's what allows them to access nutrients from the soil.
So say more about that. What do you mean they have a relationship with mycorrhizal? Can you explain it in layperson's terms?
Yeah, it's a chosen relationship, basically. The plants, there's certain nutrients in the soil, nitrogen, phosphorus, potassium being the largest ones, but also micronutrients that essentially are somewhat difficult for plants to actually access without these mycorrhizal relationships. And so the way mycorrhizal fungi work is they actually live inside and outside of the root hairs of the plants, and they pretty much facilitate the passage of nutrients from the soil to the plant. And it's a relationship that's shared because they also they feed off sugars and various byproducts that are coming from the plant. So there's this interaction that happens below the soil that most people don't realize is happening, but without mycorrhizal fungi, without saprophytic fungi, we would have a terribly difficult time growing most of our food and having healthy soils and healthy forests.
Ah, that's fascinating. Well, if you just tuned in, we're listening to the Big Fat Farm Show on KSJD. We're talking with Travis Custer today of San Juan Mycology. So let's talk a little bit about mycoremediation.
Sure.
What is it? And is it happening in the region here?
Yeah, so mycoremediation, kind of the breakdown of that is myco meaning fungi, and remediation, which is, you know, addressing contaminants within the environment and cleaning them up. So the actual definition of mycoremediation is a process using fungi to degrade or capture environmental pollutants. There's been a lot of research, mostly happening since the 80s, but this has been something that's been studied maybe since the early 1920s. And they've found all sorts of really incredible uses for fungi in environmental remediation. Most people are probably familiar with what's called phytoremediation, which is using plants as a means of cleaning up the environment. This happens often.
Can you give us an example of that?
Yeah, this happens often in a constructed wetland. A lot of municipal wastewater treatment plants also use phytoremediation.
And what kind of plants are they using then to clean?
Typically, you see a lot of marsh grasses, things like cattails. What we see in wetlands, this is kind of nature's biofilter for water. And so a lot of the applications for phytoremediation involve water filtration. Also, a lot of municipal wastewater treatment plants use different algaes and bacteria as a method for cleaning up the wastewater. And so fungi have demonstrated some pretty incredible abilities to address a wide range of environmental pollutants. They can degrade chemicals such as phenols. They can degrade petroleum hydrocarbons, PCBs, insecticides, pesticides, herbicides, industrial dyes. In an agricultural setting, people have used fungi to even filter fecal coliforms from cattle. So just they're really it's really expanding, and people are finding more and more that fungi have this incredible ability to degrade environmental pollutants.
And how much are these pollutants actually in our environment, in our soils, in our water, in our air? Is it really an issue to address? Or, you know, it feels like a lot of things get maybe taken to the dump and we don't have to worry about it.
Sure, yeah.
Is that true?
Yes and no, I think. You know, we live in an industrialized world, and a lot of these pollutants we can't see necessarily in their physical form. And so although they might not be necessarily in our face, so to speak, they do exist. One of the projects that we are currently working on is a grant proposal to do research that would involve using fungi to degrade what's herbicide contamination. There's a group of herbicides that have become particularly problematic because they have a really strong persistence in the soil, meaning that they exist in the soil for a really long time. They carry through certain natural processes that other herbicides don't. And so we're looking into using fungi to possibly address those issues as well.
Great. Well, let's take a quick break. We're going to be back with more of the Big Fat Farm Show on KSJD. And now's your time to pledge at 970-564-0808 or pledge securely at ksjd.org. We're back with more of the Big Fat Farm Show on KSJD. This week we're doing a pledge drive and we need your support. So call us at 970-564-0808 or pledge securely at ksjd.org. Today, we have in the studio with us Travis Custer with San Juan Mycology. We've been having a great conversation about mycology and mycoremediation. So let's continue with that conversation around mycoremediation.
Sure.
Talk to us a little bit about where these herbicides and pesticides even came for a way, why they're in the soils, why they're in our environment right now.
Yeah, so, you know, in agriculture, particularly industrialized agriculture, there's a huge amount of chemicals used, both in means of fertilization, but also in means of pesticide use. And pesticide use is kind of overarching. It includes fungicides and herbicides and insecticides. Herbicides make up about 45% of all the pesticides used in this kind in developing nations, and so they make up a pretty large portion of the chemicals that are used. Agriculture being, you know, a major part of industry, and it results in quite a bit of pollution. Some of these specific herbicides that we're focusing on with our grant proposal have kind of brought some new issues to the table. A lot of herbicides, when exposed to the environment, such as bacteria, different microbiotic life, the soil, water, pH, things like this, they degrade relatively rapidly in the natural environment. However, they've developed these new classes of herbicides that have a significant amount more persistence in them, meaning that they last in the environment much longer.
How much longer?
Well, it depends on the chemical. It depends on the environmental factors such as soil moisture and temperature and sunlight and the type of farming being used, whether there's a lot of tilling or not a lot of tilling, but potentially years. And so this causes a lot of problems because what's happening is these herbicides are not breaking down through processes like composting. They're carrying over from the hay that they're sprayed on into animals' manure, and then this manure or compost is being spread on agricultural land and basically contaminating soil with residual herbicide.
And what does that do to the crops then?
Yeah, these herbicides are developed to target what's understood as broadleaf crops, and so this doesn't include grasses, corn, but it does include most of what we understand to be garden vegetables, alfalfa, clover, tomatoes, sunflowers, beans, peas. The list kind of goes on. And it damages, you know, based on different, based on the amount of the herbicide that's contaminating. It can be anywhere from simply damaging the foliage to reduced yields to full-on mortality of the crop.
So it sounds pretty serious, but is that actually something that's happening in our region, or is that maybe happening just in other parts of the country?
It's happening all over the country, and it's become a pretty serious issue. It maybe really started becoming a big issue in the early 2000s when a couple major composting companies received contaminated manure from some dairies that resulted in some commercial compost becoming contaminated. And it really started to come into the light then. Since then, there's been millions of dollars in damage. I just read last night that one of these composting companies on the East Coast ended up paying out like $934,000 in damages from product that they had sold. So it's becoming an issue. It's a pretty large issue in agriculture.
And are you seeing it in this region?
Yeah, we've seen it quite a bit, actually, in this region. And part of the problem is they don't really have many answers for it. Mostly just leaving land fallow, kind of dealing with the herbicide contamination is what's mostly recommended. And so there's potential that certain types of fungi have the ability to actually degrade these chemicals within the soil.
Have you seen that as a process, or is that something you'd be studying with the grant proposal?
We'd be studying it for these particular chemicals involved in these particular herbicides, but there has been quite a bit of research done with a chemical called atrazine, which is probably the world's most applied herbicide. And in the lab, they've found really incredible results with different species of fungi being able to degrade atrazine. It hasn't been used a terrible amount in the field, and that's where more research needs to happen. But the lab work that's been done with fungi and chemicals is pretty incredible.
Excellent. That's excellent work that you've been doing. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to the Big Fat Farm Show on KSJD. This week we're doing a pledge drive, so call in now to support us at 970-564-0808 or pledge securely at ksjd.org. I have the pleasure of talking with Travis Custer today with San Juan Mycology. We've been talking about micro-remediation efforts that his company is working on. So I also want to talk a little bit about the culinary end of things. I know you grow a lot of culinary mushrooms.
Yeah.
Let's talk about types, varieties, health benefits.
Sure. Yeah, we currently grow four species of mushroom for gourmet production. We grow a white oyster mushroom called the elm oyster. We grow a tropical oyster mushroom called the pink.
A tropical oyster mushroom.
Yeah, it's a pink mushroom. It's really beautiful and really flavorful. We grow this really wild mushroom called the lion's mane that, if you can imagine, kind of a koosh ball. It kind of looks like that. It's white with these icicles hanging down and has incredible flavor and texture as well. And then we grow the shiitake, which many people are probably familiar with.
Oh. And how about health benefits of mushrooms in general? It seems like, you know, I look at a mushroom and I sometimes think of celery that maybe doesn't have much, you know, it's like, it's great to add to pizza or other, you know, pasta or something. But really, does it have very many health benefits?
Yeah, actually, you know, pretty much on the other end of the spectrum from that. mushrooms are really low in calories. They're fat-free. They're really high in protein.
They're high in protein,
high in protein. They're actually an incredible substitute for meat. They also have a really high source of vitamin D, which isn't really available in any other vegetables. Not that they're a vegetable, they're a fungi, but
that's an interesting, most of the population is deficient in vitamin D. So
absolutely,
that's
and meats can be a good source of it, but if you're not a meat eater, then mushrooms can provide that. They also have incredible medicinal qualities to them. Almost all mushrooms are immunostimulants, so they help us maintain quality immune systems that, you know, to fight off sicknesses. Most mushrooms are also proving to be, have different qualities about them that are strongly anti-cancer and anti-tumor. Some mushrooms, like the oyster mushroom, are blood cholesterol regulators. So by eating these mushrooms, we can actually also address medicinal aspects of our lives as well.
Wow.
Yeah.
That is amazing, going from looking at it as a bland piece of, you know, to how many benefits it might have.
Yeah.
So, Travis, if people want to have more information on the micro-remediation efforts or the culinary end of mushrooms, how can they contact you?
We don't have a website up yet, but people can feel free to email us at sanjuanmycology, that's mycology, at Gmail. Or they can give us a call on our business line, which is 970-570-5116. And we'd be happy to answer any questions.
Great. Thank you so much for your time. Thanks for coming into the studio.
Yeah, thanks for having us, Sarah.
Great. Well, you're listening to the Big Fat Farm Show on KSJD. Tune in 2 weeks on November 12th at 8:30 a.m. We'll be talking with Shane Hale and Kirsten Sackett from the city of Cortez. They're going to be talking about improvements in local food initiatives in Cortez. I'm Sarah Severson, your host, signing off, saying friend a farmer and pledge us this week by calling 970-564-0808 or pledge securely online at ksjd.org. Thanks for listening and have a great day.